Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Diana Bishop is a witch from a long line of witches. She knows it, but cares more about the natural world and living a life of rational scholarship. But when she touches an ancient manuscript, everything changes. Vampires, demons, love, and death. So begins a best-selling new novel by real-world historian Deborah Harkness. This hour on Point, discovering witches and a whole lot more with Deborah Harkness. You can join the conversation. Are you one of those readers who pushed a discovery of witches to the upper reaches of the bestseller lists? Are you ready to dive into Harry Potter for adults? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Pasadena, California, is Deborah Harkness. She's a professor of history at the University of Southern California. Her own research focuses on science, medicine, and magic in Western Europe from 1400 to 1800. Her new novel, it's her first, is called A Discovery of Witches. Deborah Harkness, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. This novel is poised really to be the next supernatural literary sensation as I read it. Tell me, as a historian, why a book about witches?
Well, I think I became fascinated in the fall of 2008 with why it was that so many people in our very modern, scientific, technological age seem to be fascinated by the same witches and ghosts and demons and other things that go bump in the night as my historical research subjects back in the 16th century.
And what was the answer?
Well, I think the answer is that no matter how modern and rational we like to think we are, we still need a little bit of magic in our lives. We still want to believe that there's more to the world than meets our eyes. And at least that's certainly what our fiction reading tastes seem to indicate.
The novel seems to combine historical fiction with science fiction, a bit of fantasy, some mythology, some romance. I mean, was that the intent? How did you start this process?
I didn't even intend to write a novel, so I didn't have any kind of genre expectations going into the work. I was literally on vacation in Mexico with my family. It was the rainy season, and I started to wonder whether or not my 16th century subjects were right and the natural and supernatural worlds were actually coexisting with each other. And in order for that to happen, I started to worry about what witches and vampires might do for a living in 2008 plus. And that was actually where the story began, with that very simple question: if you were a witch or a vampire, what on earth would you do for a living in the 21st century?
So unlike Bella and Edward from the Twilight series, who are teenagers meeting in the halls of high school, your leading characters are thinking about their future. They're academics, right? They practice yoga together. They discuss philosophy. These are not your kids' vampires and witches.
That is absolutely correct. I was really interested in the practicalities of what one of these creatures might do so that they could get up every day, face the day, go on, especially a vampire who's faced a lot of days in his or her life, and was also really interested in the problem of, okay, if these creatures are all around us, what are they doing all day, not just for a living, but how do they spend their time, and why on earth do humans not see them if they're in fact all around us?
So take us to the top. The novel begins with the protagonist, Diana Bishop, stumbling across a lost, enchanted manuscript in the Bodleian Library. Do I get that? Have that right? At Oxford?
The Bodleian.
Bodleian,
yeah,
Library
Bodleian.
At mm-hmm. Oxford. What is that book and what happens to her when she picks it up?
Well, the book itself is a real alchemical manuscript that's really in the catalog at the Bodleian Library, Ashmole 782. And it is really missing. So it's one of those books that I've never had a chance to look at because of its status. And so I got to imagine what it might contain. So Diana Bishop goes to the library one day in her normal routine, and she calls up Ashmole 782. And as soon as she gets it in her hands, she knows that there is something very different about this book.
How does she know that?
Well, I can read you a little bit from it if you'd like.
Wonderful.
The manuscript does not actually behave as other manuscripts do. So this is from the very beginning of the book. The manuscript that had appeared to tug on its call slip lay on top of the pile. I reached out, touching the brown leather. A mild shock made me withdraw my fingers quickly, but not quickly enough. The tingling traveled up my arms, lifting my skin into tiny goose pimples, then spread across my shoulders, tensing the muscles in my back and neck. These sensations quickly receded, but they left behind a hollow feeling of unmet desire. Shaken by my response, I stepped away from the library table. Even at a safe distance, this manuscript was challenging me, threatening the walls I'd erected to separate my career as a scholar from my birthright as the last of the bishop witches.
So probably more accurate to say that this manuscript has found her.
That's right. What she learns is that, yes, she did not, in fact, find this manuscript. This manuscript has been waiting for her.
So she's not only a first-rate scholar of 17th century chemistry, but a descendant of a long and distinguished line of witches. And what happens next?
Well, what happens next is that she goes back to her orderly life. She returns the manuscript after giving into the temptation and looking into it. No scholar can resist that. And she goes back to the library expecting everything to be the same old, but what she doesn't know is that she's not the only person who might be interested in Ashmole 782, that in fact there are a number of creatures who are similarly interested in this book and have been looking for it for a very long time. And at the head of that long line of interested parties is a 1,500-year-old geneticist, a warrior, a scientist, something of a wine connoisseur named Matthew Claremont.
Yes, a dashing geneticist, I might add. What is their journey together?
Well, I think their journey is one of first wary enmity that then leads to a kind of tense collaboration, to friendship, to something that is deeper and more romantic. So it follows an arc of relationships that I think most of us can find somewhat familiar, where some of the people we react negatively to at first turn out to be the people that we admire and respect the most in the long run.
At the beginning of the story, you mentioned this manuscript that's part of your novel, but in reality, it's missing, as it is in the book. That's a real part of the story. What is the story behind that?
Well, the book, we only know from its title and from its number. Books in rare book libraries do go missing, just as they do in your own public library, because humans aren't perfect, and sometimes a book will get misshelved. It may have been miscatalogued, and the catalog entry changed, and nobody remembered to strike out the original entry. So really, right now, all we know is the number and the title that appears in the novel is the same one that appears in the catalog, and it's a fairly common occurrence. It's one of the things scholars look forward to are those rare moments when we might actually discover one of these lost objects.
In fact, you did. This happened to you.
I did. In 1994, I found a lost magical manuscript that had belonged to John Dee, who was Elizabeth I's court astrologer. And it had been missing since the early 17th century, and I found it in the summer of 1994 when I was not looking for it. Complete accident, a little bit like Diana Bishop, although I have to say that my manuscript was not under a spell. It was just, it had just been misplaced.
In fact, you were completing your dissertation, and can I assume that this somewhat inspired the creation of this novel?
Absolutely. What I learned was that fiction is a bit like alchemy itself. In alchemy, you take very humble, ordinary things and you transform them into something that's glittering and rare and perfect. In fiction, you pull on all sorts of experiences from your life and you weave them into a story. And it's interesting to see the ways in which things will pop up in a fictional incarnation.
Well, I must say this book is on fire. After just a couple of weeks, it debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. Here's one of your new readers. Lida is calling from Winchester, Virginia. Lida, welcome. You're on the air with Deborah Harkness.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Well, I think the thing I have to say that I found wonderful about this book, and I pre-ordered it based on a review that I read prior to its release, that it was equal parts history, mystery, romance, fantasy, and the ability to weave that scholarly portion into the book is what really makes it appealing to a mature reader, to someone like me who has a historian's background. And when I finished reading it, I wanted to start it all over again, and that doesn't usually happen to me with books.
Lida, thank you. Deborah.
Oh, well, for a writer, that's the highest compliment of all, is that somebody wants to reread it, especially so quickly. But I think that it, you know, when I wrote this book, again, I didn't have any expectations of where it would fit into the world of fiction. I just started writing the book and wrote the kind of book that I myself like to read. So Lida and I's reading tastes are fairly similar. We like those sorts of blends of all kinds of different elements that somehow manage to come together and that invite us as grown-ups to suspend our cynicism and our troubles and cares, and to suspend our belief a little bit and to enter into a different world. So I'm delighted that she enjoyed it that way.
I keep hearing a fairy tale for grown-ups to describe this work.
That is when I sat back at the end of writing and thought about what have I done here. That is the phrase that came to mind, that I had written a fairy tale for grown-ups, or at least tried to.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about thoughtful vampires, resolutely rational witches, and sundry other spirits all locked in a royal battle over a long-lost magical manuscript this hour. My guest is Deborah Harkness. She's a professor of history at the University of Southern California. Her new novel is her first, and it's called A Discovery of Witches. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Deborah, take us through a little bit more. Take us into the mind of your protagonist, Diana, and this very intense struggle that she has, knowing that she has this past, this history coming from a long line of so-called witches. She doesn't want to acknowledge it, but then does. She must. Take us through her mind and what's going on.
Well, I think that she's doesn't want to have anything to do with the family business. And in her case, the family business isn't accounting, it's witchcraft. And it's a legacy that she feels acutely. She feels the burdens of living up to expectations that are set because of the people in her family who have exercised these powers before. And so for her, she just wants to live a life that she thinks of as being normal and human. She wants a rational life. And so she's picked history, which she thinks is an eminently rational pursuit. She's vowed not to let magic interfere with it. And to just further enhance that position, she has decided to study, in her opinion, the moment when science made magic go away. That moment in the 17th century when universal laws began to take over from a worldview in which the natural and the supernatural were equally plausible explanations for why things were the way they were.
Can you talk about that period a little more and the significance of that?
Sure. The 17th century is known as the Scientific Revolution. It's a period when we look and see that worldviews that had existed since ancient times, back to Greece and Rome, began to buckle under the weight of new observations, new technologies like the microscope and the telescope, new fields of endeavor like calculus, began to chip away at some of these old ideas. And so there's a period of transition where we can really see the two existing modern science and older beliefs existing side by side, and then very slowly these new beliefs begin to take over. But it was not an even or straightforward process. And some of the greatest figures of that, you know, so-called scientific revolution, men like Isaac Newton, were very dedicated to pursuits like alchemy that we might think of as not being terribly scientific at all.
And so when you teach the history of science and medicine and magic to your students and talk about Sir Isaac Newton and others. I know you urge them to have a little historical empathy with regard to their thinking, and I wish you'd tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I think it's easy for us to stand at a distance and look back and label the beliefs of the past as superstitious or silly or not making a great deal of sense. But I do think that if you think back to why they thought what they thought and try to figure out, okay, this is a very smart individual in Isaac Newton. Why is it that Isaac Newton can develop calculus in a matter of days and spend decades on an alchemical experiment? He could hold those two things in his brain at the same time. So it's really our failure to be able, if we can't understand that, it's our failure of empathy and our failure of understanding. So that's what I really encourage my students to do, is not to judge, but to endeavor to understand and to see the struggles to understand the world in the past as very, very similar to our own. They just had different tools and different explanations. And also, I encourage my students to have a little bit of humility. You know, Aristotle's worldview was around for thousands of years. The Newtonian worldview has been around for a couple hundred. So it's early days yet for us to sit back and think that we've, you know, knocked it.
One of the criticisms levied against Sir Isaac Newton, in fact, was that the theory of gravity and other things that he was thinking, that all of it was too magical, right? That it just couldn't be possible, right?
Absolutely. Gravity was action at a distance. There had been all right. of these wonderful mechanistic philosophers like Descartes who'd said the world is full of particles and they hit each other and the world's a clock. And Newton came in and said, oh, no, there's an invisible, untastable, unknowable, unmeasurable force that keeps things where they are in the world called gravity. And people thought, oh, dear, you know, we're back to square one. We've gone back 100 years in our thinking. Of course, it took centuries for someone to actually be able to put some of the specifics behind it. But Newton was on the right track with his ideas, even though it seemed very magical at the time.
So as an historian and as a professor, of course, who are some of the people today that you see on the cutting edge that are thinking big thoughts, the Isaac Newtons of our time that may seem quacky or magical at the moment?
I don't know if they seem quacky or magical, but I think that certainly figures like Carl Sagan or Stephen Hawking, some of the people who are working on quantum physics and on chaos theory have that same sort of aura of thinking so beyond what we can actually measure and map out at this point. I think even something like the study of the genome 25 years ago would have seemed like complete science fiction. How could anything reveal this many secrets about who we are and where we came from? And yet, you know, DNA research is not only solving major scientific and biological questions, it's solving historical questions as well. You know, people are doing DNA research on manuscripts, parchment on the vellum that was made from sheep skins, and being able to determine where those sheep were living, what kind of diet they had, and being able to figure out all kinds of things about the origin of ancient books based on the DNA of the sheep that went into making them. So it's a pretty amazing time right now, not just for scientists, but historians as well.
Here's a call, Deborah, from Karen in Boston. Karen, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Karen.
Mine isn't as much of a question as it is a comment. You had asked a little while ago before the break why the listeners thought that magical books, books about witches and vampires and whatnot.
Ah, Karen, I think we lost you on your cell phone. Are you back? No. All right, Karen, thank you. I'm sorry I don't have her question. We'll have to move on. Nick is calling in Waltham, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for calling.
Oh, your book sounds great. I really want to read it. I was wondering how it would compare with Jonathan Strange.
Ah, I have to confess, as a professional historian, I read less fiction than I should. So Jonathan Strange is actually on my increasingly large pile of books recommended to me by readers as something I would like. I have looked through it, and what I can tell you is that one of the things that fascinates me is that it looks very much in places like a scholarly book. There are footnotes in it, which my book does not have footnotes. That's what I do for my full-time job, so they're not in the actual book itself. So I'll have to keep you updated on what I think of Jonathan Strange, and you'll have to let me know how you think it compares.
Nick, thanks so much for the call. Here's a comment or two from our website, onpointradio.org. Jules writes, "It's a romance novel. I was not prepared for that. I enjoyed the book, even though it's not my preferred genre, but it wasn't what I was expecting. It's Twilight for grown-ups, not Harry Potter." Is that an accurate description? And what do you think generally of the fantasy genre? Are you a fan of the Twilight series and Harry Potter?
I have not read the Twilight books in their full. I have looked through them again because readers have said, oh, you know, there's this Twilight thing. My niece is 14. She's very much into it. I don't have children of my own. So I have read Harry Potter. I've actually taught Harry Potter in a course on science and magic. So I have read the Harry Potter series. And I think every reader who reads the book will find different elements in it that resonate with them. Some readers really do feel that it's Harry Potter. Others say that it's Twilight. I've heard the Jonathan Strange comment as well several times. But I think that the book is its own book, and it was not, again, designed to imitate or mimic any of those things. If it imitates anything at all, it imitates the kind of books that I read from the 16th century, plays like Dr. Faustus and plays like The Alchemist and The Tempest, where that's the magical literature that I'm most familiar with.
So this is not a fistful of Harry Potter, a pinch of Twilight. You didn't sort of take bits and pieces from the most popular or wildly popular pieces of those particular works.
No, I started with a sort of occupational survey and my discovery of a lost manuscript and my knowledge of the Salem witch trials and a little bit of my interest in science and magic, and went from there.
Well, what is the appeal to you of a vampire? I mean, what was missing in that teenage adult genre that, you know, that you wanted to capture in your own work?
Well, again, I don't know the genre very well. What I was interested in was what in the world a vampire would do every day that would keep them moving forward. And I was interested in playing with notions of really deep time. So my vampire is quite old. And as far as I could see, it's hard enough to get up in the morning every day and go to work under normal circumstances. If you'd been doing that for 1,500 years, it would be downright impossible unless you had a real calling and a real vocation and were able to do something that was long-term. So in my mind, I thought, well, vampires would be ideally suited to careers in science, and they'd be ideally suited to careers in investment banking. And those are the two occupations I started to fiddle around with, and the science had its obvious charms to me.
Read us a bit more from the book, A Discovery of Witches, Deborah Harkness. I think we have a bit here, the moment that Diana Bishop, your protagonist, first meets Matthew Claremont, who's a geneticist, an all-around hunk, wine connoisseur, but there's a lot more to Matthew's story, right?
That is right. This is a man with thousands of years of secrets. So this comes after Diana goes back to the library thinking all her life is normal and finds out that it is going to be far from normal. He was in the shadows on the opposite side of the room, in front of the paleography reference books, lounging against one of the graceful wooden pillars that held up the gallery. An open copy of Jane Roberts's Guide to Scripts, used in English handwriting up to 1500, was balanced in his hands. I had never seen this vampire before, but I was fairly certain he didn't need pointers on how to decipher old penmanship. Anyone who has read paperback bestsellers or even watched television knows that vampires are breathtaking, but nothing prepares you to actually see one. Their bone structures are so well honed that they seem chiseled by an expert sculptor. Then they move or speak, and your mind can't begin to absorb what you're seeing. Every movement is graceful, every word is musical, and their eyes are arresting, which is precisely how they catch their prey. One long look, a few quiet words, a touch. Once you're caught in a vampire's snare, you don't stand a chance.
And then another clip from the book, the scene in which Diana finally presses her vampire love interest, Matthew Claremont, to come clean on just how old he actually is, Deborah.
Yes. Well, one of the things, again, that interested my practical historian brain was if, in fact, you did have a friend who was a vampire, how on earth, if you wanted to take it to the next level, would you date this person? I thought about how much of our lives revolve around food and sharing a drink and going dancing, and I just couldn't imagine how this would work, given what we think we know about vampires. So this comes from a scene where Diana has taken the plunge and invited him over for a meal. And she's cooked a raw food diet. She's gotten some advice from the zoology department at Oxford. And as they're finishing up the meal, she finally dares to ask a question that's been haunting her for some time. And that is, how old are you? And Matthew replies, why is my age important? I'm a historian. If somebody tells me he remembers when chocolate was introduced into France or a comet passing overhead in 1811, it's difficult not to be curious about the other events he might have lived through. You were alive in 1536. I've been to the house you had built. Did you know Machiavelli? Live through the Black Death? Attend the University of Paris when Abelard was teaching there? He remained silent. The hair on the back of my neck started to prickle. Your pilgrim's badge tells me you were once in the Holy Land. Did you go on crusade? See Halley's Comet pass over Normandy in 1066? Still nothing. Watch Charlemagne's coronation? Survive the fall of Carthage? Help keep Attila from reaching Rome? Matthew held up his right index finger. Which fall of Carthage? You tell me. I believe that my body is nearly 37 years of age. I was born around the time Clovis converted to Christianity. My parents remembered that, or I'd have no idea. We didn't keep track of birthdays back then. It's tidier to pick the date of 500 and be done with it.
I'm curious how much you might have indulged your own interests while writing about Matthew and or Diana.
Well, again, I think that novelists are told to write what you know, and all of the characters in the book contain elements of me. In the case of Diana, the fact that she's a historian, she's interested in alchemy, that she rows, are all parts of my life and experience. And in the case of Matthew, his historical profile relates to my own career as a historian. And in addition, he is a man who is very interested in wine, as I am. When I was searching for things that a warm-blooded person might have in common with a vampire, I thought, well, they have to have something in common. And, well, they don't eat the same things. But then I realized that if vampires had all of these sharp senses, they must have wonderful taste buds, too. And I thought, maybe vampires can actually taste all of those things that are in the wine tasting notes that some of us read and pour over. And I thought, and they could have wonderful wine cellars given their money and how long they've lived. So pretty soon Matthew Claremont was somebody who loved wine and was interested in the history of wine, the science of wine, and had a wine cellar that any of us would love to be locked up in and retrieved a few days later after we tasted our way through it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm speaking this hour with Deborah Harkness. She's a professor of history at the University of Southern California, and her new novel, A Discovery of Witches, has got lust and love and blood and war and spells and potions, but also a lot of deep thinking about where magic and science meet. Deborah, this is your debut novel. As I mentioned, you've written previous books about science in Elizabethan England, and you've received a lot of awards and fellowships for your work in the field of history. Was it difficult to transition from writing scholarly nonfiction to a work of fiction?
It was quite unexpected. Again, I sort of started to play with ideas, and about 6 or 7 weeks later, I came out of my office and said, I think I'm actually writing a novel about this, not a scholarly work at all. And from that point on, the story had enough energy and momentum. It just kind of kept rolling. I think that the hardest thing for me to remember sometimes is that it is a work of fiction. It doesn't have footnotes, and that a little bit of historical detail and context goes a long way. So I don't want my fiction to sound too much like I'm giving a lecture. So that was one of the challenges, but it was a fun challenge to meet.
In fact, I read that you would write, you were writing 6 or 8 weeks without telling anybody. You thought of it as sort of an exercise in world building in your mind, no?
Yes, that's right. For me, again, it was about trying to imagine our modern world through 16th century eyes and imagine what would need to be in place for that to happen. And pretty soon I had a character and I had another character, and characters started talking to each other. And my little world building exercise, which is, I study world building attempts from the past, began to have a real life of its own, which is an exciting moment, as I now understand it, for any kind of creative writer. But I've never had any creative writing classes. I think the last creative writing I did may have been in 10th grade in Barbara Little's English class, where I wrote a 5-page short story. So I'm learning by doing here.
Here's a call from Anna in Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make a comment. I haven't read your Diane's book yet. I heard this radio station, and I was just so excited. I was like, science fiction and fantasy really were what put me onto the path of science, and now I'm studying biochemistry, and it's really just, I kind of went the opposite path. So
what was it about that intrigued you so much that made you want to study biochemistry?
Just exploring the world and discovering things is really my passion.
And what do you hear in Deborah's work, Anna?
I was just interested in how, she's kind of working backwards from a standpoint of history and alchemy and going into a modern-day scientist.
Mm. Anna, thank you. Right. Good luck.
And for Anna, what Matthew Claremont has in common with Anna is he is fascinated with just basic questions that are true for scientists in any time and period, which are about, who is he and why is he here? So those are perennial questions, and they still drive scientific inquiry today, whether you're a vampire or not. But one of the things that I knew was that vampires would be the kind of creatures who would find those questions very meaningful and relevant to a life that went on and on over the centuries and decades. So you can craft a pretty good research project if you're going to live that long.
You've hidden some historical details throughout this novel, Deborah. Give us some of them, some secret symbols and allusions. What are they?
Yes, scholars are treasure hunters, so I couldn't resist putting a few of them in here. Now I understand they're called Easter eggs, but one of them is actually the title itself. The title of the book is based on a book that was written in 1647, the Discovery of Witches, by a man named Matthew Hopkins, who was the witch finder general for England, and was reputed to have a book that told you all about the witches living in England at the time. Some of the characters are based on real individuals as well. The books that are referred to are either real books or books that we know the title of that might be missing. So there's all kinds of little historical nuggets. And there's one very special nod out to one of the vampires that I'm familiar with. And those are the vampires that are in Anne Rice's books. In the 1980s, when I was in college, you know, those were my vampires and witches, were the Interview with the Vampire and the Witching Hour. So very sharp-eyed readers might find a little passing reference to one of those figures in the book as they read along.
Is it true some of the characteristics ascribed to Diana Bishop and Matthew Claremont, your lead characters, were derived from the qualities in alchemy associated with silver?
Silver and gold. Well, philosophical mercury and philosophical sulfur, but they're pictured as silver and gold. And so these characters have personality traits that are related to these two metal principles. And it was believed in alchemy, if you combine these two things in a marriage, that you would get the Philosopher's Stone. So for Diana Bishop, who's related to the moon through her name and through to that philosophical mercury, we have changeability, mutability, instinct. Those are all related. And for Matthew Claremont, who's related to the gold principle, we have permanence, immortality, perfection, all of the things, some of the things that really characterize him as well.
So many names have hidden meaning is what is the bottom line.
And that's the other thing you can do. If you look up any of the names in the book, you will find that they have a hidden meaning. There's even one character whose name means fairy tale in the book, just to, again, kind of deepen the mysteries and the significance that you can pick out of the tale.
Deborah, here's another caller from Cookeville, Tennessee. Hi, Rima. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I'm so glad that somebody's writing about the history of witchcraft. I truly believe in witchcraft, but more of a historical point, and that's why I'm so glad that she's writing about the history of it, because a lot of people don't understand the basis of witches, and I don't want to, you know, mire down into this, but I think Christianity has affected the idea of a witch, and I've always been fascinated by witchcraft, and it's kind of been a conflict within me because of my history and my family of Christianity and what I believe the basis of what a witch is about, you know, the elements of the earth and what they believe in. And so what I was wanting to know is, does Christianity affect Diana in any way in the book? Does that play a part in her character?
It's a great question. Diana has been raised pagan because she does come from a family who adheres to beliefs that are associated with the Wiccan religion. Matthew, however, is a very devout Catholic. He came into the world in 500 when Christianity was new and very powerful. So another thing that I get to talk about is this kind of dialogue between pagan beliefs and Christian beliefs. And, you know, historically speaking, witches have been around for a very long time, back into antiquity, throughout the Christian medieval period, and right down into the present. And they were targeted specifically during a very definite moment in Western European history, which happens to be my period of history, 1400 to 1800, the very same time when science, as we know it, and like to think about it, came into being. So that's another reason for this story, is to talk a little bit about this tension, not just between science and magic, but also magic and religion.
Well, from our website, Deborah, Ed is quite skeptical, actually, of that part of the conversation. He says it's a worrying phenomenon that our culture is so interested in vampires and witches. Spirituality, yes, of course, but why such dark forces? Why these dark forces? Deborah.
Well, I think that anyone who's read my book will discover they're not dark forces really at all. What I tell my students is that magic and witchcraft, like beauty, are in the eye of the beholder, and that one person's saint is another person's witch. And I think that's been true historically, and I think it is still true today, that we tend to demonize what we don't fully understand or appreciate. In this case, there's really very little of the dark elements that Ed might be concerned about in the book.
Here's another call from Bob in Woodbury, Connecticut. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I haven't read the book yet, but I sure am looking forward to it. My comment is, and I think that you asked a question just before your last break, you know, what makes this kind of literature so compelling and so widely read and interesting? And I think part of it is that we live in a time where the religious narrative that used to give us meaning is starting to fall away, and folks are turning more away from classic religions and traditional religions. And the scientific narrative that promised in some ways to give the meaning to us has turned out to be kind of disappointing. It hasn't. We still live in a world that's fraught with tremendous trouble and so on. And so it's a quest for meaning, and we're finding that meaning in the stories. And as this book seems to be weaving history and science and religion together in a compelling way, I think that's exactly. You know, we lived as a species for a long time, making meaning out of our stories, telling our stories, and finding the meaning in those stories, and retelling of those stories. And I think we're coming to that time again. This author of this book seemed to be on the cutting edge of that new move. That's my sense.
Bob, thank you, Deborah Harkness.
I think that's a very eloquent way to put it. I think we are all searching for meaning. I think that's a perennial human condition. And I think the only thing that is different is how we come up with answers and where we draw them from. And I think we've come to a period where perhaps we're not as afraid to draw so many seemingly different strands together. And that's the encouraging thing, I think, about seeing people who are interested, as one of the previous callers said, you know, who is both interested in the historical phenomenon of witches, who is interested in their beliefs, who still has come, you know, sees the value of Christianity, where we don't have to make decisions about how it's one or the other, but to try to see something that's a bit more integrated.
Here's Fort Mill, South Carolina. Mickey, welcome to the program.
Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I was just calling because I thought you guys would get a kick out of this. I was driving my car, listening to NPR, and I heard about the book, and I was like, wow, that sounds really good. And I had to run into Target, so I ran in, bought the book, and now it's in the car with me, and I'm really excited about reading it. But I also wanted to share that I thought, I was thinking that I know a lot of people have had, like, mystical or paranormal experiences in their life, and they don't, like, really talk about it a lot. They kind of talk about it hush-hush. But I think, you know, I've had several myself, and I think a lot of times there's, like, this little hidden secret part of us that wonders if we have, like, some kind of secret power or something. Yeah, my gut tells me that someday science is going to prove that, you know, there is some, you know, basis to some of the experiences that we have that we can't explain right now. But I do think that drives people's interest in these kind of stories.
Mickey, thanks. Deborah.
Yeah. Albert Einstein always said that there's far more to the world than we are aware of in our everyday experience, and he was a pretty smart guy. So I would have to agree that I think that we have very powerful instincts, even if we don't necessarily ascribe those instincts to something supernatural. I think we, as human beings, have very well-developed instincts, and we have often, at our peril, learned to ignore them, so that when those strong inner voice says to us, I should do this because it's the right thing to do, or I shouldn't do that because it's the wrong thing to do, I think we can sometimes dismiss it. But the more we listen to those voices, I think many of us find the better on track we actually are in our lives.
Here's another call from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jack. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I would argue that a lot of what science has actually discarded over the last couple of centuries would appear to be, to a modern scientist, magic, but in fact is the actual nature of reality. So I think that there's a lot of things out there that science could look at yet again, but will not, because they believe they already know the answer. And that lack of a sense of mystery and the kind of a sense that we already know the answer is, in fact, part of the problem with science today.
Mm. Jack, thanks for the call. Deborah Harkness.
I think that the really good scientists, the ones who really are going to push our knowledge and our disciplines further, absolutely don't fit that profile. I think there are scientists for whom the unknowable and the mysterious is very frightening. They like their rules and their laws. And excuse me, I think that there's a place for that, certainly in the sciences. But I think the ones that we will remember, and we will remember far into the future, people like Einstein and Newton, are always the ones who can see the mystery and who want to try to explain that a little bit better. So it's a great comment.
This book is the first in a trilogy, Deborah. Can you give us a sense or a hint of what might come next?
Well, I'm sworn to secrecy, but I can tell my readers that the next book will start exactly where the first one left off. So there will be no monkey wrenches there. So if you've reached the end, you can look forward to picking up with Diana and Matthew right at that point again. It was always a trilogy in my mind. I read a lot of old literature that always seems to work in three acts. So that was the kind of story that began to take shape as I wrote.
Well, congratulations on your tremendous success of this first novel, Deborah Harkness, A Discovery of Witches. She's a professor of history at the University of Southern California. You can read an excerpt from her book at our website, onpointradio.org. Deborah, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. I hope you have a great weekend. This is On Point.